Good morning, and welcome to the West Hills Unitarian Universalist Fellowship's virtual Sunday service. We are affectionately known as WOOF. My name is Howard Baldwin. I use the pronouns he and him, and it is my privilege to serve as your lay leader this August morning. It's the second weekend of the month in August that perhaps none of us were expecting, but we're learning a lot, which is good, because this morning's service is about adapting. Whoever and wherever you are at this moment, we want you to know that you are welcome here with us. Regardless of your age or abilities, regardless of whom you love or how you identify your gender, if you do, whatever your spiritual practices may be, or if you have none, we welcome you. We especially welcome you no matter what the color of your skin is, because that's also something our service is about this morning. We are glad you are here with us. All of us local to this virtual community of conscience and compassion. I encourage you to check the announcements in your order of service to see what else is happening this week, and to join us for our virtual coffee hour at 11:30, when we will check in with each other, share our joys and sorrows, and talk about today's service. If this is your first time with us, and you don't have an order of service, but would like to know more about who we are and how we stay connected during this time of social distancing, don't hesitate to get in touch with our congressional administrator. Her contact information is on the screen. And now, as I light the chalice, the Unitarian Universalist symbol of our shared and scattered faith, let us speak together our opening affirmation. Let us open our eyes to see what is beautiful. Let us open our minds to learn what is true. Let us open our hearts to love one another. This reading is from Richard Rothstein's The Color of Law. It's the middle book on the shelf behind me. The full title is The Color of Law, A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America. Today's residential segregation in the North, South, Midwest, and West is not the unintended consequence of individual choices and of otherwise well-meaning law or regulation, but of unhidden public policy that explicitly segregated every metropolitan area in the United States. The policy was so systematic and forceful that its effects endure to the present time. Without our government's purposeful imposition of racial segregation, the other causes, private prejudice, white flight, real estate steering, bank redlining, income differences, and self-segregation, still would have existed, but with far less opportunity for expression. Segregation by intentional government action is not de facto. Rather, it is what the courts call de jure, segregation by law and public policy. Racial segregation in housing was not merely a project of Southerners in the former slaveholding Confederacy. It was a nationwide project of the federal government in the 20th century, designed and implemented by its most liberal leaders. Our system of official segregation was not the result of a single law that consigned African Americans to designated neighborhoods. Rather, scores of racially explicit laws, regulations, and government practices combined to create a nationwide system of urban ghettos surrounded by white suburbs. Private discrimination also played a role, but it would have been considerably less effective had it not been embraced and reinforced by government.
Oh, Each of us has a circle of friends, a number of people that are acceptable, important, and even dear to us, bounded by an invisible line of inclusion. That circumference is also a line of exclusion that defines those who are not acceptable to us, those whom we suspect, disagree with, ignore, overlook, or fear, sometimes at the subconscious level. The next joyful anthem invites us to expand that invisible but very real circle, to include a much wider range of people. It asks us to include in our concern and acceptance people of different race, political views, or religious beliefs, regardless of socioeconomic status, sexual orientation, or disabilities. And just when we think that we have enlarged the circle to the fullest possible extent, it asks us to expand it further, wider still, so that no one is excluded or left alone.
Today's service is entitled Waking Up to Racism. Behind me, as I mentioned, the books on the shelf, which you may or may not be able to see, are some of the books in our household that we've been reading to wake up. Books about the white experience of racism and the black experience of racism. To that end, we've asked a quartet of WWF members to speak for a few minutes each on what they've learned recently about racism and anti-racism, whether from books, conferences, or other interactions. What have they learned that changed how they see and frame issues of racism in America? You've already heard a little of the book that woke me up, The Color of Law. Now we're going to hear from Tiana Julian, Wendy Kluse, Suzanne Riles, and Jack Smith about their insights and inspirations.
Good morning. My name is Tiana Julian, and I'm honored to share my reflections with you today. My husband and I grew up in different parts of the United States, and because of that, our personal experience with overt racism differed greatly. I was raised here in the Pacific Northwest, and I'm now embarrassed to say that until recently, I was oblivious to the history of American racism and the lifelong challenges people of color face. Never once have I had difficulty securing an apartment, or been followed while shopping, or had difficulty receiving medical care for life-threatening chronic illnesses. Growing up, I had strong role models in my home, neighborhood, and in the media who looked like me. The message I received and took to heart was that hard work and determination equaled success. I had no trouble uncovering and pursuing opportunities academically, athletically, and professionally. Because this was my experience, I incorrectly believe this was everyone's experience, and if one diligently sought opportunities, tenaciously trained, or studied, success would follow. History was not my area of interest or strong suit. Then I married Dan, the history buff, and boy was I in for an education. At first, I was not open to the facts he shared. They seemed to contradict my understanding. I listened, but it wasn't until I viewed a documentary called I Am Not Racist, Am I? That I recognized the many hidden biases I carried. One at a time, I'm unraveling them, unlearning what I was initially taught, and learning historical facts. I recognize our American judicial system was created by white men for white men. Not only were people of color left out by our founders, but to this day, they're not recognized or treated as full human beings. Dan and I were blessed to parent our daughter, Grace. She's now 20 and finding her own way as a young adult. She has a brilliant mind, and she constantly challenges me to embrace truths and take action. She's currently hiking along the Oregon coast, and she's wearing a discarded Black Lives Matter yard sign on her back. At nearly 6 feet tall, with blonde hair and blue eyes, her presence is difficult to ignore. As she left Astoria and continued south toward the California border, negative reactions became vitriolic. She's been called a whore, told to F off more times than she can count, and recently, along with obscenities, death threats have been shouted at her. As her parents, this is concerning, but still, we support her. It is difficult to grasp that three simple words regarding humanity elicit such hate and anger. She knows the message she is carrying needs to be heard, and she has no intention of stopping. This is her experience wearing a sign. I cannot imagine what it's like to live life as a person of color. I do not know what Grace's future holds, but if she can remain safe, I know we sleep better at night knowing she's not alone in her quest for equity. Although racism finds its way into all walks of life, in America, I strongly believe this is a white problem and a privilege to be able to educate myself rather than experience racism directly. Our white colonial ancestors created this system. It's working exactly as it was intended, and it's our responsibility to fix it. I will continue to seek collaboration through conversation and community. It's that effort that exposed me to different perspectives, opened my mind, and helped me spring into action.
Over the past year, I've immersed myself in as many anti-racist resources and opportunities as I could. I can't in just a few minutes possibly explain all the ways these experiences helped me learn and grow, but I'll share a few of the most important lessons for me. The web of racism, classism, white supremacy, the patriarchy, and capitalism infiltrates everything. We are bathing in white supremacist culture, which makes it virtually impossible to see sometimes. What can be perceived as normal or just the way things are is actively and purposefully excluding non-white folks. We must begin to take notice of this and call it out. The more I understand what prison abolition means, the more I get on board with it as the only way forward to truly create a just society. It's not at all as scary or idealistic as you may think. I learned that white supremacist culture has robbed me of knowing my ancestors' cultures in an attempt to homogenize us into one white race and therefore dominate over other races. Being a good progressive isn't enough. I'm complicit in racist systems when I choose to not educate myself on how they were designed to benefit white people, how they harm people of color, and when I choose to do nothing to dismantle those systems. I must recognize the illusions we bought into that keep us complacent into maintaining the status quo. So here is a short list of my highly recommended resources if you want somewhere to start. A powerful speech, easily found on YouTube, by author activist Kimberly Jones titled, How Can We Win? This was so influential to me. In just 6 minutes, she gave me the wake-up call I needed. An article by David Dean titled, Roots Deeper Than Whiteness, which helped me reflect on my ancestry. We Keep Us Safe, a book by Zach Norris, shares personal stories of folks affected by the prison industrial complex. The Sum of Us by Heather McGee explains why we can have nice things and how racism hurts all of us. Beloved Conversations, an anti-racist curriculum through Meadville Lombard Theological School, dug deep into whiteness and racism, all while incorporating UU principles. And also, the words and perspectives of Black-led social media accounts such as Don't Shoot PDX, Check Your Privilege, and Anti-Racism Daily help me center Black voices in my daily social media scrolls and keep racial justice issues at the forefront of my mind. Embarking on this journey is a lifelong endeavor, a new way of being and showing up in the world. As a white person, it can be pretty uncomfortable at times, but I have also found it to be completely liberating. We owe it to our BIPOC communities to show up with love, admiration, and respect, and then keep going.
Hi, I'm Suzanne Riles. One part of fighting racism is to learn the inspiring stories of Black people. There are some great books out there, too. I recommend the following three. One, The Hemingses of Monticello by Annette Gordon Reed. Not long ago, DNA testing revealed that the rumors of history were true, that Thomas Jefferson, the founding father, often acclaimed as an early Unitarian, left descendants among both white and Black people of today. Now, a historian has written about the amazing Hemings family of the colonial era, The Hemingses of Monticello by Annette Gordon Reed. The Hemingses were enslaved members of the family that Thomas Jefferson married into. His wife was named Martha. Years after her mother died when she was a child, her father had more children with his servant Elizabeth Hemings. These half-sisters and half-brothers were enslaved, but very close. When Martha married Jefferson, Martha's father gave most of the Hemings family to her and Thomas as a valuable wedding gift in the weird world of slavery. Sally was one of the youngest and was eventually assigned to serve Thomas Jefferson's own two daughters. But Martha died young too and asked Thomas Jefferson on her deathbed never to marry again, a promise he kept. Instead of remarrying, he and Sally Hemings, Martha's sister, began having children. All of Sally's four children with Jefferson were freed at his death, as he had agreed to do. The Hemingses were very ambitious and capable people who worked cleverly in a million different ways to improve their lives and reach freedom. Book 2, Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom by David Blight. I don't know why a whole lot more hasn't been written about Frederick Douglass. He was such a dramatic figure. He was the most often heard public speaker in the United States, the whole country, in the 19th century. In his youth, he escaped a brutal enslavement to become a charismatic public speaker who worked to persuade white people how important it was to end slavery and why black people should be assisted to advance. The third book I recommend is Colored People by Henry Louis Gates, Jr. In this book, the author tells what it was like growing up in the 1960s in a small segregated town in West Virginia in a large and active family. In summary, African Americans have accomplished a great deal and continue to lead and inspire us today. Their stories are well worth reading.
What have I learned of late that changed the way I see racism in America? Like many of us who have been reading and discussing racism, I've come to appreciate structural racism as distinct from racism exhibited in the form of hurtful comments, racist displays, and intentionally cruel acts against people of color. I want to be clear that this kind of overt racism exists today, is incredibly hurtful, should not be tolerated, and when seen or heard, I have a responsibility to call it out. Structural racism, or the system of structures, rules, customs that disadvantage people of color, is subtle, yet so instrumental in preventing people of color the opportunities that white majority enjoy. It is also, by its nature, less recognizable to those of us who have not experienced its effect. My cousins in Pennsylvania are among the millions in America who do not recognize this effect. They post on social media, perhaps in response to a program emphasizing opportunities for people of color. Quote, "I worked hard to get where I am without special treatment or special help." Inferring, of course, that if only people of color would work in a similarly diligent manner, they would garner similar rewards. I knew in my heart, and to some extent in my head, that this thinking was deeply flawed. My reading and the discussion group at Wolf on the book Waking Up White gave me more understanding of its fallacy. Of the many societal and government programs that provide help to the dominant white majority at the expense of people of color minority, the GI Bill and housing are two that stand out. The GI Bill technically allows access to all military personnel to free education. However, colleges had quotas that allowed only a small percentage of blacks, called black seats. And in many cases, the level of poverty in families of people of color required a returning soldier to devote all of their time to earning a living. The result was that only 4% of people of color GIs, 4% of people of color GIs benefited from the program. In essence, the GI Bill was affirmative action for whites. Another example is housing. Owning a house has been a way for Americans to build wealth, and access to credit is essential for home ownership. Redlining is the term given to the act of classifying neighborhoods as to their desirability and determining interest rates for those neighborhoods. Black neighborhoods were circled with red lines in contrast to white neighborhoods, indicating higher risk, higher interest rates, lower housing values. Again, affirmative action for whites. So, my cousin did work hard, but contrary to their assumptions, white majority members like themselves did get help not available to people of color.
Divide down the middle. You are the caller. You are the responder.
As we extinguish the chalice, let us carry within us the warm glow of its flame and the values of Unitarian Universalism. See you soon.